it's been very fulfilling to see how people are reaching out to their neighbors and helping them as much as they can.
Kenai River flooding forces evacuations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking back on how vulnerable Alaskans have fared during the September storms.
If this had happened in the middle of winter, I think it would have been devastating for a lot of vulnerable people in the state.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The REAA school board election is October 2nd. Polls are open 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. Bring your voter ID card, driver's license, state ID card, tribal ID, or other ID when you go vote. If your name is not on the list, you may vote a question ballot. Information on the question ballot envelope is used to register or update your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring somebody to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Federal Judge John Bryan sentenced former Fairbanks Peacemakers militia member Coleman Barney in Anchorage today to five-year sentences for each of the two counts he was convicted of. The judge said the sentences will run concurrent and there will be credit given for time served. Barney has already been in jail for about a year and a half. Following his release from prison, he will be on probation for three additional years. Judge Bryan was meticulous in going through the potential sentence enhancers, taking more than an hour and a half to allow the state and defense to argue the points before finally allowing Coleman Barney to address the court. Mr. Barney started by saying he loved his family and he wanted to apologize for making poor decisions. He said he did feel remorse and he would do anything to go home to his five children and his wife. Judge Bryan asked him how he felt about the business with Schaefer Cox. Barney said he got involved in the hype, mentioning the Tea Party, and that he was with a group of Christian men who were worried about protecting their families if the government collapsed. But he said when the militia talk started, he got caught up in it. He said he was embarrassed, and if he could go home, there would never again be a problem with him. The judge said although Barney had obviously been a good family man and successful business owner, there came a time when he should have said, "This is not right. This is not what my church teaches." Barney's attorney, Tim Dooley, says he believes his client is a good man who got caught up and didn't know about the wild claim Schaefer Cox was making about the militia's power until after he was arrested and heard recordings while in jail.
He was completely unaware of the speeches by Schaefer Cox down in the States where he claimed to have 3,000 people and airplanes and doctors and machine guns. He didn't know any of that, including a speech at KJNP where Schaefer Cox said a lot of bizarre things. Well, Coleman was outside of the KJNP radio station running the security detail to make Schaefer feel better.
Judge Bryan said he was tired of hearing the group called a militia, saying they were not regulated, well-trained, or organized as a militia would need to be. He said the case was not about freedom of speech, but of violations of criminal laws. Rachel Barney, Coleman's wife, sat with his parents in the courtroom. After the sentencing, she did not wish to talk on tape, but did say the government messed up. They lied, and they should be disbarred. She said she had thought her husband would be acquitted. Schaefer Cox and co-defendants Lonnie and Karen Vernon are scheduled for sentencing in November. Floodwaters have begun to recede in Seward and points north, but the National Weather Service has extended its flood warning for the Kenai River until Thursday. As KDLL Shaylin Cochran reports, flooding along the Kenai has been reported in several areas and forced road closures and evacuations.
Reports of moderate flooding along the river near Cooper Landing came in Monday morning when the Kenai River crested at 16 feet, where it's expected to remain until sometime Tuesday. The National Weather Service's measurements Monday anticipated the river would crest at 12.5 feet in Soldotna, where flood stage is 12 feet. All of this after a long weekend surveying damage and assessing what could come next, says Kenai Peninsula Borough spokesperson Brenda Alberg.
Over the weekend, we had area residents and communities of Cooper Landing Kenai Keys and Big Eddy area self-evacuate or prepare to evacuate in the event that flooding inundates their residents.
The borough's main focus now, Ahlberg says, is on erosion in areas near the Kenai and Anchor Rivers. The Department of Natural Resources closed the Kenai River to all boating Monday afternoon. Ahlberg says they've been working closely with state agencies to coordinate relief and mitigation efforts and will continue to do so in the days ahead.
They are giving us assistance as we request resources from them, particularly as we are working on the next operational period, assessing not only damages but planning for recovery.
The National Weather Service is predicting the river will continue to rise over the next 36 to 48 hours. The rate of rise on the lower river was anticipated to slow by late Monday, with a very broad crest expected. Ahlberg says the borough has fielded just a few calls for assistance with self-evacuation.
We have provided assistance when called upon, but it's also been very fulfilling to see how people are reaching out to their neighbors and helping them as much as they can.
She says the flooding and heavy rainfall have affected some wells in the area and cautions residents who have experienced flooding to boil or treat that water before use. The Weather Service's flood warning for the Kenai River is in effect until 5 p.m. Thursday. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
In Seward, the City Emergency Operations Center is closing its doors tonight, but the center will reopen tomorrow morning. Brenda Ballou, Deputy City Clerk for the City of Seward, says some residents are relying on local water taxis to get around. Ballou says the city drinking water system remains intact.
So the water within the City of Seward is 100% safe and no problem. Anyone with well water outside of the city is encouraged to boil the water and treat it potentially with chlorine, like Clorox.
Talkeetna residents plan to hold a community meeting tomorrow evening to determine what happens next after flooding swept the town last Friday. The Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly meets tonight in emergency session to extend the disaster declaration that was issued on September 20th. In the Matsu, all rivers are below flood stage except for the Skwentna, which is cresting, and officials are forecasting another 2 days before the Skwentna recedes. The Alaska Railroad is continuing flood repair work on damaged tracks north of Talkeetna. The recent floods have washed out a section of track south of Gold Creek at milepost 261 on the main line. Crews are working around the clock to repair the track and restore service north of Wasilla. Stephanie Wheeler is the Alaska Railroad Communications Officer.
We've made better than expected progress. That area that was washed out just south of Gold Creek is nearly refilled at this point, and it looks like we'll be able to open the track back up tomorrow afternoon or evening. That is barring any additional flood damage.
The damaged track runs parallel to the Susitna River in a remote area accessible only by rail. Crews are working to rebuild the washout with air dump rail cars hauling fill material and with bulldozers from both ends of the washout. The main focus of all railroad repairs at this time is a 70-mile stretch of track between Willow and Gold Creek, which has been affected by high, fast water. After that area is assessed, railroad crews will turn attention to water erosion that has occurred all along the line from Seward to Nenana. Wheeler says service from Anchorage to Seward is not interrupted. She says the repairs and lost revenue will likely cost the railroad more than $1 million. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the new Fire Island wind farm starts feeding the grid.
Wind power is a very mature resource around the world. And for us to finally be getting it in the Anchorage area is a boon.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Falls are the leading cause of workplace fatalities in the construction industry. Your family's well-being depends on you staying healthy during the work season. Employers, for no-cost safety and health consultation and training services, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health at 1-800-656-4972. This message sponsored by the Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
A A legislative meeting in Anchorage today focused attention on how the city's most vulnerable residents fared in this month's series of wind and rainstorms. Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski called the meeting as chairman of the Senate State Affairs Committee to assess the lessons learned from the response to the damaging storms. But he came away with few answers on how to better serve disabled and elderly Alaskans. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Like many people who testified at the meeting, Senator Bill Willikowski called the September storms a wake-up call. He says most Alaskans are used to extreme weather and should be able to take care of themselves if they lose power for a few days. But he says that's not true for all Alaskans.
If this had happened in the middle of winter, I think it would have been devastating for a lot of vulnerable people in the state. So I'm hoping that we can learn some lessons from this and maybe get a little better prepared for the future.
Willikowski identified assisting vulnerable citizens is a gaping hole in disaster response. Senior Mary Jones agrees. She coordinates a group of about 30 seniors who live on the east side of Anchorage. And she says the September 4th windstorm was devastating for many of them.
Out of our 30 members, we had four that wound up in the hospital from being without power, water, electricity, whatever, for the 4 or 5 days. So we need a better answer to what do you do and how do you get help.
The power company executives and city officials who testified did not have many answers for Jones or Willikowski. Brad Evans is CEO of Chugach Electric Association. He says customers do report to Chugach if they are on life support or critically dependent on electricity for another reason. But he says those customers should call 911, not Chugach, if their power goes out.
It's all relative out there, and if we start prioritizing with that, then you're leaving thousands of other people off and traffic lights and fires and everything else. So, you know, we don't know which one's going to be the one that's the most harm. Certainly we're sensitive to individuals and we track them in our map books. There's not a guarantee when you sign up that you can get bumped to the beginning of the queue.
City officials had a similar response. Kevin Spillers directs the Anchorage Office of Emergency Management. The city did offer to help disabled and low-income residents clean up downed trees, but Spillers says it's not a good use of resources to have city workers or first responders check on vulnerable individuals following a storm.
It'd be almost impossible to maintain an up-to-date database on everybody who may have some sort of a condition. So neighbors know what's going on in their neighborhood a lot better. Our neighborhood watch program does a pretty good job of that, checking on neighbors. Church groups and other kinds of organizations are really better suited to do that. Communities that do that have a much better result in looking out for their folks than if you try and send out first responders or other government-type agencies afterwards.
After the meeting was over, Willikowski says he was surprised there weren't better solutions for helping vulnerable Anchorage residents during a disaster. He says he thinks some officials who testified brushed off the problem.
And, you know, if you've got seniors who are by themselves, who can't get around, and they're out of power for 5 to 7 days, that's a big problem. And so I think I do think there is a big hole there that needs to be fixed.
Senior Mary Jones says she appreciated hearing how top-level city and power company officials responded to the September storms. But she says at the ground level, seniors need to know how they can access help more easily during the next disaster. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Fite.
Congress has recessed until after the November election. When it returns, it will have a full slate of legislation to pass, from a defense authorization to a farm bill to cybersecurity measures. Most of the attention, though, will be placed on looming tax increases. The lower tax brackets put in place under President George W. Bush are set to return to original levels at the end of the year, and President Barack Obama's payroll tax cut will expire also. There is one under-the-radar provision, though, that could have a major effect on Alaska Native corporations and their beneficiaries. APRN's Peter Granitz looks at how ANCSA trusts may be taxed at a much higher rate, and that could mean lower payouts for some Alaska Natives.
Many Alaska Natives receive dividends from their village and regional corporations. Others receive extra dividend checks from ANCSA settlement trusts. Many, though not all, Alaska Native corporations have trusts. They are separate entities altogether from the corporations and are designed to create more revenue for shareholders. Those tax-free dividend checks shareholders receive come from a trust's annual earnings. The tax rate the trust pays on earnings is only 10%, far lower than typical corporate tax rates. Senator Lisa Murkowski says that's because of the fundamental nature of just what an ANC is.
It is not a corporation like Exxon. It is set up, established, unique under the law, a recognition that the Native people of the state of Alaska would, with their settlement with the federal government, it would be handled differently. And so their tax status has also been recognized differently.
As part of the so-called Bush tax cuts, Congress lowered the corporate earnings rate on income from ANCSA trusts. It passed in 2001, again in 2003, and it's set to expire December 31st. If that happens, the earnings on a trust will be subject to a 38% tax for any money that's not distributed. Maud Blair is an attorney with the Nana Regional Corporation. She says there's a fairly predictable result if the trust is smaller.
There will be less money going to the beneficiaries. In Nana's case, that is shareholders over the age of 65.
Last year, Nana gave out $2,000 checks. Blair says that's especially important in places like Kotzebue, where gas is about $8 a gallon. And it's even more important to remote villages, especially when permanent fund dividends are as low as this year's. Sherry Beretta also thinks a smaller pot of money means smaller dividends. She's the chairman of Chugach, Alaska. And she has another major concern, that if the tax provision sunsets, beneficiaries could be taxed on the dividends. That's never happened at Chugach, because the trust was established in 2007.
The earnings the trust receives then becomes taxable regardless of whether we distribute it. They call it a phantom tax. So we would have to do a 1099 for any earnings and basically force us to distribute all the any earnings that came from the settlement, regardless of the policy that we've developed.
Trusts are meant to grow. Paying out the entire amount every year prevents the trust from gaining interest. Beretta says Congress cannot let the provisions die because it would affect the neediest, Alaska Natives without pensions or retirement accounts. Chugach paid out $200 to beneficiaries last year. Beretta says the corporation would like to increase its contribution to the trust, in turn creating larger payouts, but because of the uncertainty, it's taking its time. Alaska's congressional delegation is united in trying to preserve the current setup, the lower rate for earnings, and keeping the dividends tax-free. U.S. Senator Mark Begich says the plan costs next to nothing in federal money, about $41 million over the next decade. His argument is an economic one.
In this case, is actually services or hard cash going to its members? And our goal is, the faster you can get that in their hands or in services, the better that's going to be for them or the economy that they're attached to.
Some lawmakers are campaigning against the stimulus bill from 4 years ago, vowing to fight any government spending, regardless of how it could spur the economy. When Congress returns in November, it's poised to address looming spending cuts and the tax increases. The task is making a small one for Alaska Native corporations just as relevant as a payroll cut that affects nearly everyone in the country. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
All 11 wind turbines on Fire Island are now generating power for South Central Alaska. Officials at Cook Inlet Region Incorporated say they've been testing the turbines and transmission lines for nearly a month now, and today it became official. All of them are feeding into the grid. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
If the wind is blowing, from now on, when you look out across Cook Inlet from Anchorage, you might be able to see them spinning, all 11 of them. The wind turbines on Fire Island are providing the first source of renewable energy for Alaska's largest city and surrounding areas. Suzanne Gibson is the vice president of Fire Island Wind and the senior director of energy development for Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, the native corporation that built the wind farm. She says CIRI completed construction in mid-August, but they've been tying up details since.
So it's sort of a checklist of things that we've had to accomplish in order to reach this date, and we felt like we were there on Friday, and so we submitted a certificate of commercial operation to Chugach on Friday, which makes today sort of the contractual effective date that we begin commercial operations with our buyer.
The buyer is Chugach Electric Association. At the beginning, the cost of wind power will be slightly more expensive than the gas they use to generate most of their power now. Chugach power costs on average 6 cents per kilowatt hour. At the start, the wind power will be 3.7 cents more. The project has been in the works since the 90s, when a study identified Fire Island as the best place in the area to capture wind power. And during the recent windstorm, Gibson says nature proved her point a little too strongly.
The wind speeds were so high over on Fire Island that the turbines actually cut out.
But Gibson says there was no damage to the turbines during the storm. The turbines are manufactured by General Electric. They tower 100 feet taller than the ConocoPhillips building, the city's tallest building. Chris Rose is with the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP, a nonprofit whose mission is to facilitate the increased development of renewable energy in Alaska. He says with gas prices expected to rise, wind power will be a money saver.
Wind power is a very mature resource around the world, and for us to finally be getting it in the Anchorage area is a boon, because I think people will understand now more that it is something that is happening in other places. It is not something that's going to happen in the future.
It's estimated the project will provide 4% of Chugach Electric Association's power, or enough electricity to power about 4,000 homes along the rail belt. Rose points out that Iowa started out much the same way as Alaska, but now supplies about 20% of the state's power via wind. Rose says he hopes Fire Island is just the beginning.
I think this is the start of many other renewable energy projects that are going to be going into the railroad grid.
The turbines start producing power when the wind reaches 8 miles per hour. CIRI officials say the entire project costs $65 million to build, but state and federal grants are helping pay the bills. CIRI has permits to build 22 more of the wind turbines. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The city of Tanana is looking forward to lower fuel bills. The city is adding new biomass systems, enabling it to swap high-priced oil for locally available wood. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Tanana, an Athabascan community of 300 at the confluence of the Yukon and Tanana rivers, was one of the first in Alaska to employ biomass when it set up an initial heat and hot water system in 2007. City manager Bear Ketzler says they're now expanding the number of buildings served by wood-fired energy.
We have biomass systems into our teachers' housing. We're installing one into the school. The fire hall is under construction right now for a biomass system. We've already tired our water and sewer plant, and we just completed last week our city shop. So you know, we're probably going to be displacing close to 30,000 gallons here in the next year and a half or so of diesel fuel, just moving to biomass.
Ketzler says with fuel oil currently running $5.50 a gallon, going to wood keeps money in the community.
Firewood, of course, is readily, it's local. Most of it comes right off the river. It's driftwood, and it makes employment opportunities that normally wouldn't be there.
Ketzler says the city of Tanana has patched together funding from a number of state and federal agencies to support construction of the biomass systems, which he says have cost about $1 million. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Donlin Gold Mining Company, which wants to start an open-pit gold mine near Crooked Creek in the Middle Kuskokwim River area, sponsored a tour of the Fort Knox gold mine in Fairbanks. The day trip allowed 30 stakeholders from the YK Delta a firsthand look at an open-pit gold mine in operation. KYUK's Sophie Ivan traveled with the group and has the story.
This is the first trip to Fort Knox, and Donlin stakeholders and
that is Donlin's Community Development and Sustainability Coordinator, Vernon Jimiralga. The Fort Knox mine is owned and operated by Kinross. Kinross employees gave us a safety briefing and safety gear before bringing us around the major points of the gold mining operation. Starting with the pit where the land blasting happens, dynamite lines could be seen down below, where detonation was scheduled for 3 in the afternoon. Crooked Creek IGAP coordinator Alex Felker was on the tour. He says it was nice to see the mine in operation.
Crooked Creek has always supported people searching back in the Black Hills looking for gold. So as long as they keep truthful and honest with us, we support them.
Napaskak Tribal Administrator Stephen Maxey expressed his fascination at having seen the Fort Knox mine in person. He says he marveled at all the equipment and how the rock is crushed. He says he has no opinion right now for or against the mine, but that he would report back to his village and talk about all the jobs the Donlin mine will create. The Donlin Gold Project estimates that up to 1,400 year-round jobs will be created in the projected 27-year lifespan of the mine. Qipnuk resident Curtis Mann was on the trip on behalf of the Nelson Island Consortium. The consortium includes the native villages of Dununuk, Niuktak, Chfarnuk, Tuksukbay, Qipnuk, Nikhtamut, and Unkumut. It was formed in 2003 to protect the Yupik traditional ways of life. Mann made these comments during the Fort Knox visit. He says he has a lot of concerns toward the mining industry and how the mining operations could adversely affect our subsistence hunting and gathering. That is his fear. He hopes that their operations go well when and if mining operations happen. He also hopes that they will always keep in mind how much Yupiks depend on subsistence. Donlin Gold has been conducting environmental studies for 16 years and started the permitting process last month. Donlin wants to start construction by 2016 and says construction will take another 3 years. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Van.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shailen Cochran in Kenai, Alan Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Sophie Ivan in Bethel. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. A fall can cause traumatic brain injury and require follow-up care outside of your home community. To help prevent falls, eat foods that are rich in calcium and vitamin D, like fish head soup and kelp with herring eggs. Be active, walk often, participate in subsistence activities, and have your vision checked at least once a year. More information at anthc.org. This message sponsored by the ANTHC Injury Prevention Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.